You are aware that the debates in academe are largely reserved for colleagues. The motto, publish or perish, is alive and well in academe. But the impact of Dr. Conquest's work has directly affected the lives of hundreds of millions around the world in every walk of life. Conquest's pursuit of truth was a lonely one. His work was secretly translated in the Russian underground press, proving once again the power of ideas over tyranny's every attempt to suppress truth. Our next speaker will discuss the impact of the lessons from Bob Conquest's scholarship. Aaron Wilczewski is professor of political science and public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Former president of the American Political Science Association. Now, I've got a long list here. Now, you can't come up here yet. Author of The Moral Collapse of Communism, Poland as a Cautionary Tale. Author of Searching for Safety and many other works of this caliber. I am pleased to present to you Aaron Wilczewski.
What is telling truth worth? What does it matter that against odds and hopes one spends a lifetime telling truth? In the 1970s, after several years of effort, my family got our cousin from Odessa, who had to leave everything in the world, children and family, everything she held dear behind, so she could come and visit us as a tourist. One day, we found her under the bed, with a flashlight, reading Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag, with the sides of the beds closed around her. She had been a doctor in the Gulag, and she understood full well what had happened here. What does it matter for a scholar to be punished as well as applauded for telling the truth? I first heard about Robert Conquest's work not from an American or English publisher, but from a Soviet citizen in Moscow. And then, somewhat shamefacedly, I went back to my library in Berkeley and began to read this material. And so I have thought before coming here about what the significance of this work has been in the past, and even more importantly, what it signifies to us now. For this, we need a larger canvas. According to those who lived in that era, the decade or two before 1913 represented a world forever lost, a world much safer and saner than they claim anything we have known. The British peace movement claimed that rearmament was the work of the devil and that there was no evil intent in Germany. Recent historiography from the German side now reveals that the Kaiser and his generals planned everything, and that what has been presented to us as a kind of spasm response, A mobilizes and B follows and C does the same, was in fact a well-planned maneuver. Those who said these things have yet to realize that they bear a deep responsibility because the peoples of the Western world lined each other's young men up, row upon row, and mowed them down with machine gun fire morning, evening, and night. They created a situation out of which Nazism and then Stalinism came. We have suffered then 75 years of bestiality. Yet in 1913, the world's nascent democracies knew no natural predators. There was no one able to defeat them militarily. It is we in the West who did ourselves in, partly by lying to ourselves, partly by self-delusion. But we did it nevertheless. What should we say then about this 75 years in regard to the work of Robert Conquest? We honor the chronicler. We know now who told the truth and how much truth there was to tell. Conquest's work is remarkable in that, on the one hand, he maintains the historian's craft. If all you read was the history, you'd see fact piled upon fact, evidence upon evidence in unending profusion. He accompanies this with a sense not of blame, but of vast compassion. I think Rudy Rummel has calculated that something like 200 million lives were lost or tortured or deeply deprived in that period of time. Yet there were very few who told it as it was. So we honor the historian for following his craft, and we honor the man of humanity who understood, as the man in Russia told me, what it was to have suffered from the outside to tell it to the people inside. It is one thing to suffer greatly. It's another thing not to be able to understand why this is happening. It is perhaps even worse to believe, as many Russians did, that no one outside their limited circle had any idea of what was happening to them and why. And for that, they felt grateful, as we should, to Conquest. But there's more. Consider the unique events of the last couple of years. Say, the Velvet Revolution. Why was it indeed that there were, outside of a little fuss in Romania, there was hardly a shot fired? Are we to believe, really, that they lacked the capacity to use force in Czechoslovakia, in what was then East Germany? Of course not. Are we to believe that they suddenly reinvented moral scruples when they had killed and maimed and tortured so many? Certainly not. What happened, I think, was many things, including a very poor economy, but without the work of Robert Conquest and a few like him, this would not have happened, in my opinion. The reason is that that work had a marvelous combination. You are evil, and you are ineffective. Merely telling them they were evil, as he well knows, and do then, would not do the trick. But combining the correct words for what they were with the view that any society of free people would always outperform any society of slaves gave them the understanding necessary for the Velvet Revolution, namely that after they killed their children and their children's friends, they would also be unable to rule, they would also be behind. So what was the point? One time I was in Leningrad lecturing on Watergate, and they just couldn't understand. This was at a university, party apparatchiks here and there, and they just couldn't understand. How many did Nixon kill? How many tens of thousands did he imprison and torture? I mean, what was this about? He lied. Everybody lies. But when I said, of course he got caught, and they understood he was, the light dawned, like the light bulb in the comic strips, he was inefficient. That bothered them. So I think that we have Robert Conquest to thank for that marvelous combination of truth, of moral condemnation, and the underside of it, the belief that free societies would prevail. It is worth speaking truth to power over the decades because they have to listen. They may not believe it under the most favorable circumstances, but as life changes, as it must, that message we now know does get through. One more thing. If we turn to the present era, I have an eerie feeling of 1913 deja vu. The world's democracies now have a monopoly on large-scale, serious power. No combination of the non-democracies, good, bad, or indifferent, could overthrow us in any way by force. A qualitative revolution has also occurred. It has always been true from Gideon's army before and after that highly trained and qualitatively superior individuals could beat much larger forces. But now, as the Persian Gulf War demonstrated to us, unless you can construct and program missiles to go around buildings so CNN will not be inconvenienced by a little war, you cannot compete in big time force. You see that our Defense Department does as it should. Scenarios of likely threats, but they can't make it. They can't take them seriously, and we can't take them seriously because there is no strategic threat. The consequence of this is that we are the guardians of civilization in the world. If we, the world's democracies, with all our imperfections, stand for what we have stood before, over time, the rest of the world has figured out that if you are capitalist and if you are free, you do better than if you are the reverse. So that over time, we can expect more people to get wealthier and freer and things to get better if the world's democracies stay democratic. So what then have we learned from conquest? To honor the truth teller, to speak truth to power, to support the rule of law, to follow even more the rules of civility in public life, without which free peoples cannot stand, to honor our traditions. It is quite true, of course, that when you look into the history of traditions, as Conquest does in one of his most interesting books, you discover they are flawed and they are not entirely what they are cracked up to be. I hope those of us here realize that nobody would have a friend or get married if everything had to be exactly as it was cracked up to be. Mr. Conquest is in favor of a certain passage and story in the Bible, which I rather like as well, the story of Naboth, whose vineyard was taken from him by the machinations of the wicked king Jezebel and the worst dupe, Ahab, here, and who nevertheless stood out because in his religion the land and the spirit were collected and it was against the rules of God to give up your possessions. Our possessions are not in the land. They are in liberty. And yet, there are those, even now, who would have us give them up because we are somehow imperfect. That is human. The best way that I can say what I think is Robert Conquest do, because his work is meaningful for us now in the struggle to maintain democracy as it was before, is to read one of his poems, a tribute to George Orwell. And if you will join me in just changing the name, you will get the point quite well. I apologize in the name of poetry that this is legible, and you will have no trouble understanding its significance. George Orwell, in Arias from a Love Opera. Moral and mental glaciers melting slightly betray the influence of his warm intent, because he taught us what the actual meant. The vicious winter grips its prey less tightly. Not all were grateful for his help, one finds, for how they hated him who huddled with the comforts of a quick remedial myth against the cold world and their colder minds. We die of words, for touchstones he restored the real person, real event or thing, and thus we see not war but suffering as the conjunction to be most abhorred. He shared with a great world for greater ends that honesty, a curious, cunning virtue. You share with just a few, with just the few who don't desert you, a dozen writers, half a dozen friends. A moral genius and truth seeking brings sometimes a silliness we view askance, like Darwin playing his bassoon to plants. He too had lapses, but he claimed no wings, while those who drown a truth's empiric part in dithyramb or dogma turned frenetic, than whom no writer could be less poetic, he left this lesson for all verse, all art. It may be that Mr. Conquest thinks he's going into some sort of retirement. My sense of it is that democracy needs him more now, perhaps, than before.
The impact of Dr. Conquest has been enormous. But has the general public been made sufficiently aware of the devastation and the folly of total statism? Are we in the U.S. not in danger of statism by gradualism right here? Our next speaker, John O'Sullivan, with his outstanding knowledge of journalism and politics, is in an enviable position to address these questions. Currently editor of National Review, having taken over from Bill Buckley in 1988, think on that for a minute. Mr. O'Sullivan has been a columnist for the London Sunday Independent and the Sunday Telegraph, associate editor of the London Times, editor of Policy Review, and a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard. Formerly a special advisor to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who, as you know, is a sponsor of tonight's meeting. His articles have appeared in a list of publications as long as your arm, and I will not take away his time to read them all to you. Commander O'Sullivan is a trustee of the Thatcher Foundation and was made a commander of the British Empire in the 1991 New Year's Honors List. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that kind introduction. It's an enormous pleasure to be asked to be here tonight and celebrate Bob Conquest's contribution to scholarship, and it's an enormous privilege, albeit a slightly daunting one, to do so in such distinguished company as Mr. Milosz, Ms. Bonner, and Professor Wildavsky. Now, in such company, one doesn't attempt to compete with them in philosophical reflection, in political analysis, in moral insight. but my qualifications for being here tonight are slightly different. The first is that I am the bearer of a message from Lady Thatcher, or as I prefer to call her, Prime Minister, that I shall read out later as a sort of climax to my short speech. The second capacity I speak in tonight is as the editor of a magazine to which Bob is a distinguished contributor. He is, in fact, the very best of contributors, namely someone whose copy goes directly to the printers without the slightest intervention necessary from me. Indeed, his last book contained a foreword that said, "Portions of this book appeared originally in Izvestia and National Review." We at National Review have good reason to be grateful to Bob. When the last August coup in Moscow occurred, he was the first person I telephoned to get some guidance on it. Although we put the magazine to bed at the very moment when the tanks were still rumbling towards the Russian White House, we were able to publish an interview with him that forecast the early collapse of that coup. And our editorial predictions, based entirely on his advice, were that the Soviet Union and the CPSU would shortly be a bad memory, Gorbachev discarded, and Russia restored in Boris Yeltsin's image. As an editor, I can tell you, I have to be profoundly grateful to a contributor who can enable the magazine to seem so prescient. So I was glad to be able to thank Bob tonight, and glad too that National Review has been able to repay in small part that debt with Charles Furbank's review of his biography of Stalin. This was less a book review than an examination of Bob's entire corpus of historical and literary work, and it made the essential point that in Bob's work, scholarship is always allied to clarity and common sense. His achievement has been to bring great truths and sometimes terrible facts before the great mass of the public, not to debate minutiae in the decent obscurity of learned journals. My third credential for being here tonight is as a member of Bertarelli's Lunch Club in London. Not many of you will have heard of that, perhaps. It was a gathering of conservative writers and journalists in the 1970s, presided over by Bob and by Kingsley Amis. It was, as you might imagine, a very convivial and entertaining table, especially on those occasions when Signor Bertarelli donated a bottle of grappa. But it was more than that. At a time in the early 70s when official conservatism in England was defeatist and supine before the intellectual fads of the 60s, the Bertarelli's Club, in its inebriated way, generated a stream of sharp criticism of that seedy status quo. Those criticisms covered the entire spectrum of politics, but in particular, Bob and Kingsley helped to stimulate what became known as the Black Papers on Education. Then denounced as reactionary and elitist, now accepted as having been a commonsensical corrective to the educationalist nonsense of that day. I mention that because Kingsley Amis has said, in my view rightly, that one of Bob's great gifts is his genius for light verse. And Bob often employs that gift to prosecute his political and philosophical battles. In one of those is a poem called A Grouchy Goodnight to the Academic Year, in which he took on the educational fads of that time. I'll quote simply a few lines from it. "Those teach who can't do," runs the dictum. "But for some, even that's out of reach. They can't even teach, so they've picked 'em to teach other people to teach." And it ends with, "When psychology meets education, a terrible nonsense is born," or words to that effect. Through the medium of Bob's journalism, he did much to invent and to spread the ideas that later became Mrs. Thatcher's revolution. My fourth qualification tonight is that in the mid-70s, I actually shared an apartment in London with Bob. We were both bachelors, he a temporary bachelor, I a still temporary bachelor, And among the many things I learnt from the experience of sharing that flat was his technique of inviting girls out to lunch. My own technique was to invite them out to lunch at the Ritz, which did a lot for my waistline, not much for my bank balance, and not much else either. But Bob would invite a girl around for lunch at the flat. She would arrive, he would offer her a gin and tonic, he would take her into the kitchen, he would open the fridge. In the fridge there would be a can of sardines, some baked beans, maybe a few olives, the remnants of last night's salad, and he would say, "Well, there you are. Do you think you could do anything with that?" A moment later, she'd have the apron on. Half an hour later, we'd be eating a very pleasant lunch. It always struck me the success of this technique was quite remarkable. And then I read his limerick, which went as follows: "My demands upon life are quite modest. They're just to be decently goddessed. Astarte or Isis would do in a crisis, but the best's Aphrodite, unbodiced." Well, Aphrodite arrived not long afterwards from Texas, and Bob has been very decently goddessed ever since. I can say that as someone who's often eaten at their table, that I'm jolly glad she doesn't like sardines. Now, let me now return to my first qualification. I believe that my part in history, my little footnote in history, will be that I effected an introduction between Bob and Mrs. Thatcher. He began giving her advice on the spot and has continued to do so to the present day. Now, I believe that Mrs. Thatcher's instincts on foreign policy were always sound and would always have taken her in the right direction. But she didn't have the experience or the knowledge or the background in that area, and she knew it. And she knew that around her there weren't many people who would give her the right kind of advice. And when she found someone like Bob who was giving the right kind of advice, she accepted it, and I believe it has materially contributed to the events of the last 15 years. Not perhaps as much as his scholarship, but certainly to a considerable extent. And she asked me tonight to read the following message to you and to him. "I was delighted to be asked to be co-chairman of your dinner, and I'm only sorry that I cannot be present with you tonight. When the history of the West's victory in the Cold War comes to be written, a special place will go to Robert Conquest. His scholarship and eloquence have always been put to the service of a remorseless search for truth. Truth about Stalin's terror. Truth about the evil system which generated it, along with so much other suffering. Truth about the dangerous delusions so long entertained by so many in the West about the nature and intentions of the enemy. Long before I became Prime Minister, I listened and benefited from Bob Conquest's wise advice. And during the years when I sought to strengthen the West resolve in support of President Reagan's strategy for freedom, I always knew I could draw on Bob Conquest's masterly analysis. So I take special pleasure in honoring this very English Englishman who has made his home in the United States and who has done so much for both our countries, for the West, and above all, for that cause to which he has always held, the truth." That's Mrs. Thatcher's message. Now, perhaps I could add a last word of my own. As you've heard from the other speakers, Bob's range of interest is quite phenomenal: novelist, literary critic, poet, science fiction writer, as well, of course, as the more familiar roles of historian and poet. I like to think that one of his the best examples of all of his genius as a light verse writer and as a historian came together in a little limerick that goes as follows. "There was an old Marxist called Lenin, who did 1 or 2 million men in. That's a lot to have done in, but where he did one in, that Marxist called Stalin did 10 in." Bob is such good company, so perennially entertaining, so effortlessly amusing, that sometimes it's quite difficult to remember that he's a great man as well.
Thank you, John.